Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With a lot of personal effort and public battle, America has cut way back on cigarette smoking in the last few decades. Now comes a new player, e-cigarettes, puffable cigarette-sized tubes of nicotine that are showing up all over. The old tobacco companies are pushing them hard. Some public health figures see them as a welcome alternative to tobacco. Others say they'll drag us right back into that whole swamp. This hour on Point, the rise and risks of e-cigarettes. You can join us on air or online where this conversation's always on. Have you tried them? Are they cool? Are they a good way to kick the cigarette habit? Could they lead us right back to Tobacco Road? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we're going to talk about the trend of big companies moving their retirees off of their health care plans and into private exchanges. IBM's just done it. Time Warner, it can be a shock. But first, on e-cigarettes. Joining me first today from Atlanta, Georgia, is Christy Ashwinden, health columnist at the Washington Post and this year a fellow at the Carter Center in Atlanta. Christy, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
I had barely noticed anything about these until, I don't know, a year or so ago I began to see the ads. What's going on with e-cigarettes, their penetration of the market, I guess? How much is going on? How many, is it a big deal?
It really is. Bloomberg Business Week is projecting that the market for these things are going to double this year to $1 billion. So that's a lot of money. This is a market that's traditionally been filled by smaller players, and now that the big boys are getting in on it, Altria, the number one tobacco cigarette maker, is now getting into the market, Reynolds also. So I think we're going to see a lot more here.
Christy, what is an e-cigarette?
So it's basically a little device that has liquid in it, which is the thing that you vaporize. This is the carrier of the nicotine. I think it's important to point out this is not a tobacco product, so there's no tobacco in it. But it has a little battery and a heater, and the heating element heats up the liquid and vaporizes it. And so that's what the person who's using it will breathe in. It's actually called vaping instead of smoking.
Okay.
And so the liquid that's vaporized can have a lot of different things in it. It has nicotine. It can have flavorings. Some of these devices are disposable, so they're already preloaded. You vaporize them a few times and then throw them out. Others, the users can actually mix up their own vapor liquid and add different flavorings and things like that. It's also possible with some of these to titrate the amount of nicotine in them. So
titrate, you said, like what, control? You can have more or less nicotine if you want more, a bigger or smaller hit?
That's correct. And in fact, in my Washington Post article, I mentioned I spoke with a user who has actually used this feature to reduce the amount of nicotine that he's taking in. So he actually got himself off nicotine by over time, slowly reducing the amount of nicotine that he's putting in there. This is one argument for them. Now, it doesn't mean that everyone's going to do that.
I saw it for the first time recently. I saw it in public. I just hadn't noticed it, but I was at the car wash waiting for the car to come through, and there's a couple of guys, and interesting, one of them smoking a cigarette and the other one smoking an e-cigarette with that sort of distinctive, not smoke, but puff of vapor, little cloud that comes out with the exhalation. What's the difference health-wise between, smoking a tobacco cigarette and smoking an e-cigarette or vaping an e-cigarette?
Yeah, well, at this point, there's a lot of hypotheses, not a lot of really strong data yet. One thing that did seem pretty clear when I was reporting and talking to experts, there does seem to be pretty widespread agreement that the vapor is less harmful than a tobacco cigarette smoke, just in terms of particulates and the things that are in the smoke or the vapor that you're taking in.
The tar and toxins in tobacco, not here?
Exactly, exactly. There have been some studies looking at what's in the vapor, and there are very, very small amounts of a few things that could be potentially problematic, but they're so low. I mean, there's very little debate that it's less harmful than regular tobacco smoke. The question, though, is how much less harmful, and, you know, can we say that these things are safe? And that's an unanswered question at this point, I think.
It's being promoted in any number of ways, and we'll talk about that in this hour, but among them, as a way to get off of tobacco cigarettes. Interestingly, even by heads of tobacco companies, of course, they're in this business now. You know, I'm looking at the chairman of Lorillard, and they're big into e-cigarettes. Now, Murray Kessler is saying, you know, maybe the most significant harm reduction opportunity, i.e. harm from tobacco, that has ever been made available to smokers. Is it a fair argument that this is great? This is like a nicotine patch. This is a way out.
Well, that's the argument that's being made. And, you know, there haven't been a lot of good studies looking at how people use them, you know, whether they're as effective as things like patches, et cetera. I mean, there's not really any reason to think that they wouldn't be. The FDA has not approved them for that use. It doesn't mean that it's not happening. There's a lot of anecdotal reports of people doing this. So it's clear that people can use them in this way. The question is, you know, how effective are they for that? And one concern that a lot of public health officials have is that it's just going to sort of prevent people who might have otherwise stopped smoking to continue their nicotine habit.
What about nicotine habits in kids? I'm reading here Thomas Frieden, director of the CDC. They've done a big study, and he says this is really taking off among kids, kids smoking e-cigarettes. What about that prevalence, and what's it mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the splashy headline is this new CDC report, which is based on the National Youth Tobacco Survey, found that the use of these e-cigarettes has more than doubled for U.S. middle and high school students. And that sounds really alarming. But when you look at the actual numbers, it's still, when you take a small number and double it, it's still a small number. So the number of high school students who have ever tried an e-cigarette was 4.7% in 2011. In 2012, it was 10%. If you look at kids who had used an e-cigarette in the last 30 days,
yeah,
that was only 1.5% in 2011, and in 2012 it was 2.8%. So we're still talking about fewer than 3% of kids that have used these things in the last month.
But if you chart a graph, I mean, you can see how it's headed up, and they're selling these in cola flavor and chocolate and lemonade and cherry crush. I mean, they may say it's to get off of cigarettes, but that clearly looks like a play for young e-cigarette users. You know, what about the fear that they, you know, have an e-cigarette? Yeah, it's not tobacco, but you get a taste for nicotine. You may end up right back in the tobacco smoking world.
Well, that's right. If you look at, you know, I think one concern that a lot of people have is if you look at how these things are being marketed, you can go on YouTube and see Jenny McCarthy. She's well known for her anti-vaccine, anti-science crusades, but she's starring in some ads. It's really clear that they're selling these, you know, based on glamour and sex. And the concern is that this will get kids hooked on nicotine. And then the question is, if they're hooked on nicotine, will they also go into smoking tobacco cigarettes? And that's an unanswered question. I don't think anyone knows whether that will happen, but it's clearly, you know, obviously no one wants to get kids hooked on nicotine. That's probably not a good idea.
But could happen. I mean, it's right in the tubes here, right in the e-cigarette. Christy Ashwinden with the Washington Post joining us from Atlanta, Georgia. Thank you so much for being with us, Christy.
Thanks so much.
Here's one of those Jenny McCarthy ads pushing the e-cigarette blue. Said it makes her feel better about herself smoking this instead of tobacco.
I get to have a blue without the guilt because there's only vapor, not tobacco smoke. That means no ash, no odor, which also means I don't get the stink eye from others. Also, it doesn't make my hair smell, my teeth turn yellow. You get the idea. That's why I am in love with blue e-cigs. Now that I've switched to blue, I feel better about myself.
E-cigs, hey, they're great, says Jenny McCarthy. Well, let's talk about it. Joining us now from Hartford, Connecticut, Michael Siegel, doctor of preventive medicine and professor of community health science at Boston University School of Public Health, co-author of Marketing Public Health. Michael Siegel, welcome to On Point.
Well, thanks for having me.
And with us from San Francisco, Stanton Glantz. He's professor at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, director of the Center for Tobacco Control Research, co-leader of the Tobacco Control Program at the University of California, San Francisco. Stan Glantz, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
We just got a couple of minutes before the break. Michael Siegel, first to you. Is this a sort of a back door into the whole world of nicotine addiction and maybe ultimately cigarettes? Or is this maybe a great way to get Americans who are cigarette smokers off of tobacco?
Well, I think it really depends on how it plays out. I think it has the potential to be a tremendous innovation that could be one of the greatest advances of our time in terms of getting people off cigarettes. The advantage of these products is that they, unlike any other product on the market, it treats not only the nicotine addiction, the pharmacologic addiction, but also all the other aspects of cigarette addiction. You know, people who are addicted to cigarette smoking are not just addicted to the nicotine. They're also addicted to the behavioral aspects, holding the cigarette, feeling the throat hit, seeing the smoke.
How does it treat nicotine addiction? It provides nicotine. Couldn't it produce a nicotine addiction? Wouldn't it?
Well, the intended use of the product is for people who are already smokers. And the reason the product was invented in the first place was as a device that would help people to quit smoking. And this is the primary use of the product. It's the way it's being used by the majority of people who are using this product. And it really is, unlike nicotine replacement therapy, which can't possibly replace all the behavioral aspects of the addiction, this really can do that. And that's why it's been so successful. That's why it's reaching $1 billion in sales. And that's why it's the first real threat to profits of cigarette companies, to reducing cigarette sales and really making a dent in cigarette-related morbidity and mortality that we've had for
Michael,
a long
stand
time.
By. We just got half a minute before the break. Stan Glantz, we'll come back to you. But top line, is this the salvation for America's continued tobacco addiction?
I don't think it's salvation, but I think it could certainly be an important contributor to reducing tobacco-related morbidity and mortality.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the growing popularity of e-cigarettes and whether they're a welcome alternative to tobacco or maybe a dangerous new addiction, a new gateway to nicotine and maybe smoking. The ads are suddenly all over the place. There's no restriction on these ads, unlike tobacco ads, at least not yet. We may see some soon. Here's an ad for the e-cigarette company Blue featuring actor Stephen Dorff.
With Blue, you can smoke at a basketball game if you want to. And how about not having to go outside every 10 minutes when you're in a bar with your friends? The point is, you can smoke Blue virtually anywhere. We're all adults here. It's time we take our freedom back. Come on, guys. Rise from the ashes.
Take our freedom back. Rise from the ashes. But it's that old cigarette handling and puffing that gets a lot of people here. Dr. Michael Siegel is with us from Boston University's School of Public Health. Stanton Glantz is with us from the University of California, San Francisco, big in the tobacco control research front. Stanton Glantz, let me come to you. What do you think of the rise of e-cigarettes? Good thing gets people off of cigarettes, or bad thing for some reason?
Well, I started out agnostic on e-cigarettes, but the emerging research is all pointing in the direction that they're actually going to increase the total harm from tobacco.
How?
There are now three studies, good studies, of the effect of e-cigarettes on people quitting. They're widely promoted to help people quit, as you heard from Mike Siegel.
Yeah.
But one randomized clinical trial that was just published last week found that they were no better than traditional methods of the nicotine patch. But more important, there have been two large population studies, one done in America, England, Canada, and Australia, and another of people calling quit lines here in the United States. And the population level studies, one of them showed that they had absolutely no effect on quitting. And the study from the quit line callers showed that e-cigarette users were actually about 50% less likely to quit. So they actually seem to be inhibiting quitting.
Less likely than nicotine patch users? Less likely than that? Is that what it meant?
Well, the study that was a head-to-head comparison with nicotine patches found that they weren't any different. But the problem with all clinical trials is that they give you the most optimistic read just because it's such a highly controlled environment. It's much better to look at what's happening out in the population as a whole. And one of the good studies showed that the e-cigarettes didn't have any effect one way or the other, but that means they didn't help people quit.
But you're saying more than that.
They actually inhibited quitting.
Well, you're saying it would take us to more tobacco use. How would that happen? Okay, we can debate whether how effective they are at helping people quit. How would it actually increase the tobacco presence in this country?
Well, there's three ways that it would do that. The first way is by inhibiting quitting, because if fewer people are quitting, that means there's more remaining smokers. The second thing is that all of the studies show high levels of what's called dual use, and that is with people concurrently smoking e-cigarettes and conventional cigarettes. And there are two real issues with dual use. One is that if you continue smoking cigarettes while using e-cigarettes, even if you cut down the number of cigarettes, which people seem to do, you're still suffering most, if not all, of the risks associated with smoking the cigarettes. And the second concern is that, and the ad you just played for Blue made this point explicitly, mm-hmm. Right now there's a lot of places you can't smoke, and that encourages smokers to quit. It provides an environment that's supportive of decisions to quit. And the e-cigarette can become a bridge where people can engage in their nicotine addiction, servicing that indoors in a lot of places where right now they can't. And then the third problem is illustrated by this new CDC report that came out last week, mm-hmm. that shows very rapid uptake among kids. And, you know, it may only be that 3 or 4% of the kids are smoking e-cigarettes right now, but the direction is pointing up. And it's also important to recognize that there isn't that much smoking among kids. And again, among the e-cigarette use among kids, there's very high levels of concurrent smoking, about 80%. But that means that about 10 or 20% of these kids are initiating with e-cigarettes. And we don't know whether those are kids who would have smoked cigarettes, which is what, you know, the optimists would say that would be mm-hmm. a good thing, or if they're initiating with these e-cigarettes, which are heavily marketed to kids with flavors and sure. sex and movie stars, mm-hmm. and then go on to smoking conventional cigarettes.
Initiating a relationship with nicotine is what you're saying.
There. Right. And the e-cigarettes are not nearly as good at delivering. I mean, they deliver lower levels of other toxins. But they don't. But you know, the problem is what you're comparing them to. They are, as you heard at the top of the hour, mm-hmm. delivering much lower levels of toxins than a cigarette. But the problem is a cigarette is ridiculously toxic. So if you take something that's ridiculously toxic and you're only delivering, say, 10% of that, in an absolute sense, it's still a lot. And the same is true for the use indoors. They're heavily marketed, claiming that all they produce is harmless water vapor, and yep. that's just not true.
What is the problem with that?
Well, there are a few studies. They produce formaldehyde. They produce acetaldehyde. They produce tobacco-specific nitrosamines, which are highly carcinogenic. They put ultrafine particles into the air, which can cause heart attacks, lead, cadmium, nickel, other heavy metals.
Okay, that's a list. Stand by. We want to go back to that point. And Michael Siegel, I want to get you on this perspective, but we've got a lot of listeners here with direct experience, and I want to turn to them a bit as well. Brenda in Columbus, Georgia. Brenda, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm the parent of a young adult who has, in the last month, started using an e-cigarette. And we are pleased for her, and she's pleased because it's more socially acceptable. She, even at her young age, she was concerned about the aging effects of tobacco smoke.
Sure.
She reports that she has reduced her tobacco smoking by 75%. But I appreciate the doctor talking about that it's so ridiculously toxic. Even though she's reduced, she still is taking in bad toxins from the tobacco. So I appreciate that research out there.
Brenda, there's your daughter trying to get off. But so she's down on her cigarette smoking. But even though she's using e-cigarettes, she still smokes tobacco, Brenda.
That's right. Much less.
Yeah.
But now and again. She reports that, you know, like a pack is last that might have lasted her one day is lasting her several days. So she is way down.
Yep.
But we would like her to get entirely off. And I guess the physician who just spoke talked about the word quitting. I would like a definition of quit. Does quit mean quit vapes and cigarettes, or does quit mean quit cigarettes? I would like her to quit cigarettes altogether, and I would like her to taper the nicotine in her vapes.
That's a great question. We'll look at that. What is quitting even going to mean in this e-cigarette era? Brenda, thanks for that. Josh in Charleston, South Carolina. Josh, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What's your experience?
Used to be a pack-a-day smoker for about 3 years. Started using e-cig. It did take me a couple of tries, but once I finally got, like, a decent one instead of the gas station
okay.
type ones that you can get, like, the blue or that, but one of the more customizables.
Yeah.
I haven't bought a pack of cigarettes in months, and any time that I've, you know, wanted to take a drag off of somebody else's or whatever, I mean, I can't stand the taste anymore. I mean, it's disgusting to me, and that's kind of, I can actually say that's kind of for the flavors that they give you.
Yeah. Josh, you know a lot about this. Help us understand. How does the cost compare, a tobacco habit, cigarette habit, versus an e-cigarette habit?
Oh, it's phenomenal. I'd say I was pack a day, you know, maybe more on the weekends.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was probably looking at, you know, 40 a week in cigarettes. I have to stop by the e-cig store now once every 2-3 weeks, and I usually spend about $25-$30.
So much less expensive for you. And let me get one more, and I'll take it all to our expert guest, Leah, in Worcester, Massachusetts. Leah, you're on the air.
Hi. I used to be a heavy cigarette smoker, and I switched to the e-cigarettes. And I have a number of friends who were heavy cigarette smokers and used the e-cigarettes. I no longer use the e-cigarette, but it's the psychological aspect that you're earlier guest mentioned that made it easier to quit smoking with the e-cigarette. And there's also a stigma with the e-cigarettes as well, because you're still going through all the same actions. And there's a lot of stigma around smoking.
And what's the stigma there exactly, Leah? You're not killing yourself with the same ferocity with an e-cigarette. People just don't want to see that kind of cigarette behavior, that toying with the stuff.
I think it's the stigma against addiction.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You're still chained to it. But I think it's a positive thing. It's a great invention.
I appreciate your call, Leah. All right, let's dive in. We have many more callers, but Michael Segal, first to you. What do you make of these? You know, here we've got reports from a mother who sees her daughter there but is still worried about some ill effects of e-cigarettes. Our caller who's from a pack a day to down by near zero, and Leah who's off cigarettes but still feels a stigma. What do you make of that profile, Michael?
Well, this is the exact profile of people using the product. I mean, these are basically the three situations that can happen. Situation one is that you can reduce your cigarette consumption but not be able to quit completely. Number two is that you can actually quit. And number three is that not only can you quit smoking cigarettes, but you can quit using e-cigarettes as well. And that's why this is such a tremendous product. And I think that if we're going to evaluate this, I mean, you know, I think Dr. Glantz made some statements that are just incorrect. And I think that we have to play fair and look at the actual science. First of all, he mentioned the study that involved people calling quit lines and cited that as evidence that e-cigarettes actually inhibit quitting. And what he's not telling people is that this study wasn't actually designed to evaluate the effects of quitting. It didn't look at the quit rates of people quitting using e-cigarettes. It looked at the quit rates of people who had failed to quit smoking using e-cigarettes. So actually, this was a population that was resistant to quitting, and no wonder they didn't do as well. Secondly, he talks about levels of tobacco-specific nitrosamines, but what he's not telling listeners is that the very same level of tobacco-specific nitrosamines are also present in nicotine patch and nicotine gum.
Are nitrosamines dangerous?
Well, what they are is a byproduct of nicotine. I mean, of tobacco.
Are they dangerous?
they're not at the levels that are present in nicotine patch and nicotine gum, no. And so this is a non-issue, the fact that there is tobacco-specific nitrosamines in these products. It's a trace level that's present because the nicotine is extracted from tobacco.
So there's you're no saying way to, avoid to that. Our mother, mom caller Brenda, who's now listening and worried about our toxins and her daughter's e-cigarette habit, are you saying no worries, Mother Brenda, or we don't know for sure yet, or what?
What I'm saying is that her daughter has made the biggest step that she could possibly take, which is that she's gotten off of the most toxic consumer product out there.
Cigarettes. She's partly off. Not off. Partly off.
She's partly off. She's reduced by 75%. That's a great accomplishment. But not only that, but she's reduced her level of addiction to these products. She's greatly reduced.
How can you say that? She's still using nicotine, so why isn't she addicted?
Well, I didn't say she's not addicted, but she's greatly reduced her level of nicotine. You heard from the third caller that after a while, when people use electronic cigarettes, the appeal of smoking decreases and eventually they're able to get off. There's hope for her daughter where there wasn't before.
Let me get one more caller and I'll come to you, Stan Glantz. Stephanie in Stuart, Florida. Stephanie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just had a comment about my husband's experience with the e-cigarettes. He is basically a two-pack-a-day smoker.
Whoa, okay.
He quit for 9 years, but then got into an emotional situation where he just fell back into it, and that's a tremendously important habit to him. He tried some less expensive e-cigarettes. I finally bought him a higher quality one. You know, I'm trying to think maybe this will help.
Yep.
Anyway, he did get to the point for a while where he had cut back, I would say 70% on the number of tobacco cigarettes that he was smoking and using the e-cigarette a great deal. But eventually, it just wasn't, again, the comment always, it's just not the same. And so it may be helpful to some people, but for a really hardcore smoker, it's really not going to, at least in his experience, it was not a success at all.
Stephanie, I appreciate your call as well. Stan Glantz, there's yet another testimony from a listener here. What do you make of what we're hearing and from Michael Siegel, Stan?
Well, Mike listed three of the positive possibilities with e-cigarettes. There's a few more, and one of them you just heard about from the caller, and that is that the use of e-cigarettes could either not make any difference at all in terms of people quitting, or it could actually lead to increased relapse. And if the optimist view, if the story that Dr. Siegel was saying was the rule, you would have seen e-cigarettes associated with increased successful quitting in the two studies that I cited, the two population level studies, and they weren't. Again, one of them showed no effect. The other one showed a negative effect. And so what that means to me is that for everybody that they might help quit, and there may well be individuals that they might help to quit smoking, then there's at least somebody else or maybe more than one other person where they're inhibiting quitting.
What about young
and again,
brains?
The big issue, the big issue is this dual use. If you have somebody who even cuts down by 50% or 3/4 the number of cigarettes per day they're consuming, that has essentially no mortality benefit. And, you know, for heart disease in particular, which is what kills most smokers, there's a very steep what's called dose response curve. If you even smoke one or two cigarettes a day, you suffer pretty much the entire risk, heart disease risk, of smoking. And the thing is, we don't know what the effects of these low levels of carcinogens and heavy metals are that people are being exposed to through e-cigarettes. There's no evidence of a threshold effect for any carcinogens. And the you know, again, to compare them to cigarettes, yes, they're exposing people to lower levels of toxins than cigarettes, but in an absolute sense, they're substantial exposures. So the way I talk about them is not to say they're safer, but to say they're less dangerous.
What about the effect of nicotine itself on young minds? I mean, this is nicotine delivery systems.
Oh, yeah.
Is that okay or is that a problem?
Oh, no. That's a very serious problem because kids who use nicotine, it actually affects their brain development. So these new results from the CDC of high use among kids are very, very troubling.
You know, after all the work this country went into getting away from tobacco, this is a big, important deal. Maybe, Michael Siegel says, a good thing. Maybe not. We're going to continue to watch this as use appears to take off. I want to thank you, Stanton Glantz, at the University of California, San Francisco, and you, Dr. Michael Siegel, at Boston University's School of Public Health. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're going to take a turn on the health front here. Very interesting news out there. Big employers, IBM, General Electric, Time Warner, and more, recently ending their retiree health plans, moving those retirees to private insurance exchanges, takes the financial burden and risk off the employer and puts it on to the retiree. We're going to look for the remainder of this hour at these private health exchanges, what big companies are doing, what's going on here. Big, well-capitalized employers, the Wall Street Journal is saying, aren't likely to keep providing the once common benefits to retirees as medical costs continue to rise. It is happening. Joining us now from Washington, Julie Appleby, reporter for Kaiser Health News. Julie, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
So we've got these great big companies who you would think could afford this, who must have promised it to their retirees, 110,000 retirees in the case of IBM. But here's Time Warner, here's GE last year, saying, no, we're going to give you a lump sum, sort of the same thing that happened with retirement funds years ago. Lump sum, put you in an exchange, and you're on your own. Why are they doing this, Julie?
Yeah, Tom, well, you know, I think there's two trends converging here. One is this long-running decline in the number of employers that are even offering health benefits mm-hmm. to retirees. So right now there's only like 16% of private sector workers currently employed with firms that even get retiree coverage.
For retiree, not when they're working, but in retirement,
not
it's become
working,
quite
yeah,
rare.
No, this is a retirement, okay. Right. It's quite rare. Only about 16% of workers are currently at a firm that even offers it.
Where do they get their coverage then, Julie? Where do they get their coverage?
Well, then they go on They'd go on Medicare. And what the retiree coverage often does is either help them get a Medicare supplement plan or they can go on this Medicare Advantage, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So that's where they get their retiree coverage. The ones that IBM are shifting are the ones that are Medicare eligible.
Okay.
We're not talking here about the early retirees. Okay?
Right.
So that's a different ballgame. So the second trend is that more employers are moving to cap their expenses by paying a set dollar amount towards coverage. They've dubbed this defined contribution. And it's like you mentioned, it's kind of like the move from traditional pensions to 401k plans. So they give workers money, and sometimes it's active employees as well as retirees. They give them a certain amount of money, and the workers often have to put in some of their own as well to purchase coverage from a menu of choices offered by the employer. And then that's when these private exchanges come in. They may send them to this private exchange that has a list of, you know, menu of different employee choices for health coverage, and the employee gets to take this money that the company has given them and purchase one of these plans.
I mean, IBM came out and
doing here.
Oh, and they came out when they announced this and said, "Look, we can't keep this up because costs are going to triple." It left me wondering, well, wait a minute, what's going to happen with those retirees in the exchange? I'll ask you that, but let's listen for a second here to IBM's chief medical director, who was talking when all this came out to the public. This was Q. Rhee was his name, explaining the move to healthcare exchanges in this video released by the company last month.
IBM is making a Medicare exchange available to you because the rising cost of healthcare in the current group coverage model is no longer sustainable for you or the company. In fact, we project that healthcare costs in the current IBM plan will triple in the next few years, largely impacting your premiums and out-of-pocket costs.
Okay, Julie, help us here. If IBM can't cover the costs of healthcare, if it's no longer sustainable, how are these individual retirees out in the world of exchanges supposed to keep up?
Yeah, this is a big question. This is a big question for employers. This is a big question for retirees. And what this idea does is give workers a set dollar amount and retirees a set dollar amount. And the reason that IBM and other companies see this as a way to make their health costs more predictable is because they can decide to raise that amount a little bit every year, right? They could give the retirees a little bit more money every year. But often it's tied to how much wages go up, right? So wages may go up 1% or 2%, maybe 3% in a good year. But healthcare inflation traditionally outstrips that by a large margin. So let's say the contribution goes up maybe 10 bucks a month, right? But the cost of the health coverage goes up 20 bucks a month. Well, the worker or the retiree then foots the bill for the difference. So that's how the companies are saving money, but it does shift more money to the workers. Now, the supporters...
More money or more cost to the workers?
More cost to the worker out of their own pocket. Now, the folks that promote these marketplaces or this idea say that they think that increased competition among the insurers is going to help slow that rise of health care costs over time. And, you know, we'll sort of see how that plays out, but that's the theory behind this, is that they're going to be on this marketplace, the retirees or the workers will be picking and choosing among these plans, and there'll be some competition.
But it doesn't add up. I mean, does this make sense? IBM says costs would triple if you stay with us, but go over in this exchange and everything's fine. That doesn't read. I mean, are they just going to be saddled, the individuals, with all these costs? Why could it be tripling for IBM, but just fine for you, dear retiree?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what IBM's situation is. All I can say is that, you know, in general, when these employers have moved to this defined contribution approach, their reasoning for it is that they can cap the amount that they put towards the cost.
Well, sure, we get it for them, but doesn't that just leave the individual facing that tripling in cost that IBM...
It does indeed.
Is this in effect...
More and more companies are...
I'm sorry, Julie. Is this in effect big companies sloughing costs off on the government, on the public, because these people will sooner or later end up in Medicare rather than sticking with their corporate retiree health plan?
Well, they may have gone to Medicare anyway, even in their corporate plan, but I think where the government issue may come in is if more and more employees don't have coverage through their jobs or are going out into the marketplace and they go to these new public marketplaces, right? The public exchanges, which are different. They're opening up in October, and these are the ones where people can get a subsidy to help them purchase coverage if they're within a certain income range. So that's a potential thing there. If we see more employers, you know, dropping health coverage altogether or sending folks out to these exchanges to get a subsidy, that could increase costs.
Could that end up making the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, more costly than has been predicted?
That could be true. If they have to pay out more in subsidies, it will make it more costly.
Which sounds like another kind of transfer of the burden, you know, of living, of costs from the corporation to the individual, and in this case, to the government itself. Julie, stand by. I've got a caller here from Bowling Green, Kentucky. George, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What's your story?
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate the call. Mm-hmm. I'm an IBM retiree, retired in 1992.
Okay.
And when I retired, IBM made a specific commitment to fund my health care to a maximum. Their contribution to my health care premium was $3,500.
Per year?
For all the years since 1992, that commitment from IBM has not changed.
Okay.
Now, what they've done historically, at least in my opinion, is transfer those funds to a selected group of private insurers, different by state. And from that selection in Kentucky, I could choose a private carrier, and IBM would fund them a $3,500 contribution toward that premium.
Well, this sounds, George, like you've already been in the kind of structure that they're talking about now, a fixed contribution from them, and then you make a choice about who covers you. This doesn't seem...
That's exactly correct. And what IBM has said going forward is that the method they've used historically, they are unable to control its costs the way they would like to control them in dealing with the private market the way they do. So they've chosen a company called Extend Health, who is national and who negotiates on behalf of their clients for private insurance coverage, from which I can still make that same kind of selection as I did before.
So in your case, George, are you okay with it?
So for me, I don't see a significant change in terms of the way IBM deals with health care for me.
Julie, I'm confused a little bit by George's story, because it sounds like he's in a situation with IBM where they've already had a fixed contribution.
Did they increase your amount every year, or did they leave it at that same $3,500 every year since you've retired?
To the best of my knowledge, it's been a $3,500 contribution for the entire 20 years I've been retired.
Well, that would be a shrinking...
Have you had to pay more out of your own pocket toward that coverage?
I would have to say that the increases have not been draconian. I pay on the order of $350 to $400 a month for health insurance, which for two adults, both Medicare eligible, is not a killer. I would love for it to be half that, but given the realities of medical costs, I find that to be reasonable. My co-pays are reasonable. My formulary for pharmacy is reasonable.
Yeah. Hey, George, you've been retired since 1992. What about just going to Medicare and, you know, being done with all this? How would that work for you?
Well, I am a Medicare-eligible person.
Yes. So
Medicare is a player for me. Right now, they are a player through a Senior Advantage program that I have. But I could step outside that, take another insurance plan, and use a Medicaid policy if I chose. What I've chosen to do is stay inside a Senior Advantage plan, which is then paid by Medicare and by IBM and by me.
A retired IBMer who sounds on top of it many years after retirement. George, I appreciate your call. Julie, I'm not sure quite what to make of that story. I'm not sure where the change comes in if that's the way it's worked.
Yeah, it's not real clear to me either, Tom, frankly. I'm not sure, unless they have been increasing that amount to the insurer over time, and you know, it looks the same to Tom, because it looks the same to George, because he's paying about the same amount every month, but maybe the company itself is paying more to these insurers and has just decided that it wants to get out of that and let Extend Health worry about that in the future.
Yeah, maybe so.
And I think some companies also want their retirees out of their risk pool of active employees as well. They want them on Medicare. They want them out of the way because they don't want the additional cost. I mean, it costs more generally for health care the older you get. So that could also be one of the reasons why some companies, and I don't know the specifics about IBM's decision, but that could be why some companies are moving to this model as well.
Let me bring Teresa Ghilarducci in right here, labor economist, nationally recognized expert on retirement security, economics professor at the New School, also a court-appointed trustee of the United Auto Workers Retiree Medical Benefits Trust. It's a not-for-profit health exchange set up by the big three U.S. auto companies in 2007 in the financial crisis. Teresa Ghilarducci, thank you very much for being with us.
Right. I can help clear this up a bit. In 2007, right before the financial crisis, the United Auto Workers negotiated with the big companies because the big companies were being pushed by their shareholders in the way that Julie says, to get rid of the risk. It wasn't the cost so much, but it was the risk. So the auto workers, about a million of them and their dependents, negotiated with the companies, and it didn't save the companies any money, to actually be put into a healthcare trust fund. It is a defined contribution, but enough money, $50 billion all total, was put in the trust to last 80 years, the whole generation of the current workers and the current retirees.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had experience of about 3-4 years of this, and there could be some good news here, and I'm not usually one that bears good news.
Okay.
So let me frame it. So what IBM workers are doing, they're not unionized, or Time Warner or GE, they're not unionized.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing what these bigger corporations, auto companies, did 5 years ago. They are not obligated, as we well know, to provide health insurance for anybody. That's why we have a healthcare insurance crisis, and that's why Obama and Obamacare is trying to solve that. So they could actually dump their retirees at any time, and it's almost a surprise to us all why they haven't done it sooner.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, a lot of people felt like this was just a commitment of employer and employee, and, you know, it's not necessarily law of the jungle. That's not what we thought was driving our society or wanted to be driving our society.
Well, it operates in a lot of other places in labor relations, but you're right. They were cared about their reputation risk and their commitment to their former employees, because actually if they dump those former employees, it could affect productivity of their current employees.
Plus, they made a commitment. I mean, it was a deal. I wouldn't
be
so casual about that.
I'm not casual, but in shareholders meetings, and they rule the roost, they are. So I agree. It's they made a commitment.
Okay.
They should try to adhere to it. And the way they found a way out. They're going to cap their liabilities, lower their costs, and shift responsibility to the government and to the employees. But as Julie was saying, that was happening anyway. We heard from the IBM worker, he was more gently treated, that his premiums started to go up. And if you heard carefully, he was already in Medicare,
right.
And Medicare was his primary payer. So the company was only paying a couple of $1,000 a year anyway.
What does this mean for costs for individuals? Yeah. And what does it mean for costs for the government if corporations slough this off?
Yeah, no, no. And corporations and Detroit, the city of Detroit,
yeah.
A lot of public employers are going to find that the exchanges are a great way to move away from their retiree health care obligations. If you're pre-Medicare, meaning that you are a retiree before the age of 65, the cost to the employer can be up to about $20,000-$25,000 per year.
Employer or employee?
Employer. Employer.
That's what they're walking out on now.
Yeah, that's what they're walking out of. And the employee pays a huge amount. But Julie, I'm going to correct Julie a little bit. Right now, the fastest growing group of people without health insurance were older people who were dumped by their employer, who had to retire early. And Julie, they don't go to Medicaid. You have to be poor to do that.
I hope I didn't say they went to Medicaid. I think I said
okay.
Medicare.
Oh, good. Okay. Mm-hmm. But before 65, they have no place to go. And in fact, they're going uninsured. The exchanges help solve that problem because they're going to get people onto some kind of health insurance before they hit Medicare, and that actually may reduce the cost to the government in the long run.
Are these people going to end up on Obamacare exchanges, Teresa?
Yes, Obamacare exchanges.
And what if those aren't there?
It's possible if they don't have employer coverage, they could go and get a subsidy on the exchange. But if they have some kind of employer coverage, then
they won't. They're retirees,
right?
Early retirees, right. Now, this is a very special group. It's probably about 1 million or 2 million, you know, this year. So, look, they're retirees now. They're this special group of retirees. 18% of them are getting coverage from their employer. So let's just talk about the people who are retirees and they're younger than 65. That's the group that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
For right now, if they're not covered by their big corporate retiree plans or their city or state retiree plans or the federal government, they're out on their own anyway, Tom and Julie.
That's the world we're moving in here. And IBM, GE, Time Warner, many more saying, off you go, dear retiree. We're out of time right there. We're going to keep on top of this as Obamacare moves in. Teresa Ghilarducci, please, thank you for joining us. And Julie Appleby at Kaiser Health News. Thanks to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.